All right, there we go. We're on the air. Wednesday morning Bible study on the book of Acts. We're going to do chapter 23 today. Again, chapter 23 is not super long. I can finish it in one class. You know, if it's a long chapter, I try to split them in half, but otherwise I don't. So, if you remember what's going on, just to refresh your memory, back in chapter 21, and near the end of chapter 21, there were Jews from Ephesus who recognized Paul in the temple. And that got them all upset. And they were upset because they claimed that Paul was teaching against Moses' law, which he wasn't. And they also falsely accused him of bringing Gentiles into the temple, which was a big no-no. So they started a riot, and they were going to beat him and possibly even stone him. And then in chapter 22, we hear the Roman tribune, and the barracks for the Romans are right next door to the temple on purpose. He hears of the commotion. He comes and he arrests Paul because he thinks Paul must be the instigator. Paul asks, he says, no, I'm not. I'm not that rebel you think, but can I talk to the crowd? The tribune gives him permission. He tries to settle the crowd down, which he sort of starts to do. They were listening to him. And then he mentions Gentiles, and they get all flustered again and all upset because that's their false accusation. So they start rioting again. So the tribune takes Paul into the barracks, and he says, well, let's interrogate Paul to find out the truth. We're going to interrogate him by flogging. Oh, you remember that, Vespi?
Oh, yeah.
I think that's, on the one hand, it's funny, but if I'm the one being interrogated by flogging, it's not funny. And that's when Paul plays his citizenship card. Why he waited so long, I don't know. But he said, are you really going to flog a Roman citizen without a trial? Oh, that put the brakes on everything. So the centurion talks to the tribune. They stop the whole proceedings, and then they keep Paul in custody, and then the tribune commands the Jewish leaders to come to a council, and they're going to put Paul on trial. And that's where we start chapter 23. So Paul, this is his trial before the Roman tribune and the Jewish council. Okay? Any lingering questions from last week or any thoughts or comments from last week, just kind of bringing you up to speed? Okay, there's going to be some drama today. Last night, my wife was here last night with the Bible study, and she said, boy, that chapter is like a lot of drama. I said, yeah, it is. There's a lot of drama in this. So here we go. Ready? Chapter 23, verse 1. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. In other words, my conscience tells me I've done nothing wrong. What I have done, what I have preached, what I have taught, what I have said is all above board. It's public and it's according to God's will. That's basically what he's saying. Okay? Verse 2, and the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Boy, that reminds you of something, doesn't it? Jesus at his trial. Then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck? Okay, so let's talk about that for a minute. So there is a very minor debate among some, and when Paul says God is going to strike you, is he proclaiming a curse upon the high priest, or is he just predicting what will happen, so prophesying? Is it a curse or a prophecy? Yes. Well, I would say, yeah, he might answer yes. That is a possibility. But I would lean towards, personally, towards that this is just a prophecy of what's going to happen. Jews were not known to inflict curses upon someone. That's not something Jews would do. It's not something Christians do. People who say that they are going to put a curse on someone or a hex on someone, that's a pagan practice. So Paul's not likely to proclaim a curse upon the high priest. Likely what he's doing here is just proclaiming the future. God is going to strike you. Just beware, God will judge you. And why? Because you're judging me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you order me struck. I looked that up. And I failed to put it in my notes, but somewhere in Leviticus, I don't remember where. I think I found it in chapter 15, but I'm not recalling. I didn't write it down. God tells Moses, as part of the law of the people, do no injustice in court. So, according to God, God's law, the Jewish people, when somebody was on trial, they were not to be harmed. They were to be protected while on trial. Well, that makes sense. We do that even today, right? Yeah?
Leviticus 19:15.
There we go, Leviticus 19:15. So, right here, the high priest is upset with Paul because they claim he's breaking God's law by preaching against the Mosaic law, and yet he breaks the law by having him struck. Yeah, Dale?
To me, the phrase, you whitewashed wall, is Paul saying, you who look falsely pure.
Yes, and exactly a lead in to my next point I'm going to make. Perfect. Yeah, Fred?
I have reference to Matthew.
Matthew.
Where Jesus said, woe to you scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones.
Yes, so that's where I'm going next. So
in that verse it says, I have lived my life before God in good conscience. What about the people he killed?
Paul?
Yeah.
Well, he's talking about since his conversion. Yeah. Before his conversion, yes, he lived a life that was not pleasing to God. So, back to this whitewashed wall. So, we just had like two comments about it, references to it. So here's the explanation. Some of you might already know this, so I apologize. It might be something you already know. We know that according to God's law, the Mosaic law, if you touched a dead body, you were unclean. Now that was a big deal because you were unclean for 7 days, and that meant you could not go in the temple. Well, the temple is the source of all things spiritual. It's the source of community. It's the source of fellowship. It was a big deal. So to be a pallbearer for another family when they are burying their loved ones and you're literally carrying, you know, you'd have 4 or 6 or 8 guys carrying a dead body to bury it, that was a big deal. That was a great favor because you're touching a dead body. Well, what are the Pharisees known to do? And Jesus chastised them for this. They take God's law and then they reason out all the little details about it. And they create extra details to the law which didn't exist or weren't part of what God said. So, for instance, if you're carrying a dead body, touching a dead body, you are unclean. What if you walk over the grave of a dead body? Does that make you unclean? Well, the Pharisees decided yes. Well, God doesn't actually say that. Now, so for that reason, because they claimed if you just walk over a grave, you're unclean. Secondly, for the purpose of not desecrating the grave, okay, I could kind of understand that a little bit, walking on a grave. So therefore, they would whitewash the graves so that you would not walk on it. So they had some kind of white varnish or white paint, and yes, they would paint the ground. Here's the grave. And yes, it would wear away or wash away over time, over some number of weeks. They'd have to redo it periodically. And if you were buried in the side of a hill, in a cave, they would always put a stone in front of it to keep animals out, and they would whitewash the stone. So it was kind of a similar practice. Don't touch this stone, because that will make you unclean. Well, God never said that. Just by walking over a grave of a dead person, you're unclean? God didn't say that. But the Pharisees, you know, they make up all these details. Like, for instance, another detail. If you walk so far, it's not considered work on the Sabbath, but if you take one step beyond that, it is considered work on the Sabbath. I think it was like 2 miles or something. They make up all, Jesus chastises the Pharisees for making all these little details and rules. Well, whitewashing tombs was one of them. And that quote for that Fred read in Matthew, Jesus is comparing the Jewish leaders, especially the Pharisees, to whitewashed tombs. They look good on the outside, but what's inside? Corruption and dead bones. And so that's what Paul is saying here. He's calling the high priest a whitewashed tomb, that you look good on the outside, but inside you're corrupt. Now, were the Jewish leaders corrupt?
Yes.
Yeah, most of them. There were some that were not. There were some that tried to be faithful. You know, Nicodemus, for instance, yeah. You know, there were some that tried, but many of them were corrupt. They used their power for personal gain. That's corruption. Okay? So that's what he's saying here. And he's saying God is going to strike you. Now someone last night pointed out, and I saw this as well, I think it's in the Lutheran Study Bible footnotes, that Ananias the high priest was a particularly cruel leader. And he was hated by his own people. And during a rebellion, sometime later, a couple years later, I think, his own people assassinated him because they hated him so much.
Wow.
So that tells you something about Ananias. Whoa. This is a different Ananias than at the time of Jesus. Okay? Time of Jesus, that was like 35 years ago, or 25 years ago from this point. So this is a different Ananias, same name, but different Ananias, particularly cruel high priest. So Paul's prediction, we know from Jewish history, did come true. God struck him down. Okay? All right. Any other questions or comments about all of that? A little bit of a field trip for you, Bob.
Yes.
Yeah, Linda.
What about Lazarus?
What about Lazarus?
Well, was he whitewashed?
I would suspect, yes, the tomb that he was placed in was whitewashed. Just kind of as a warning or a sign, there's a dead person here, don't touch. But of course, Jesus, we know this. See, here's a, if I can roll this into another further thought, and I've mentioned this before in sermons because I think it's very profound. Touching a dead body makes you unclean. Touching a sick person makes you unclean. Because sickness is the result of sin. Death is the result of sin. So touching that makes you unclean. So if you have a sick person in your house, you're unclean for a lesser period of time, I don't know, matter of days, and then you can't go into the temple during that time. What did Jesus do quite often, but not always, when he healed somebody who was sick? He touched them! And in one case, when he raised the son of the woman at Nain, he did three resurrections before his own. When he raised the son, he touched the dead body. What is that doing about him? According to Jewish law, he becomes unclean. But this is part of our theology. Because what does Jesus do with all of our sin? He takes all of our sin to himself. He absorbs it all like a sponge. And he deals with it right there on the cross. So if Jesus were alive or on earth, he is alive. If Jesus were on earth today and he were going around healing people, he'd be touching them. And he would be taking their sin, their sickness, into himself while giving you health and healing. Does he still do that?
Yes.
Yes, he still does that. Oh, it's so wonderful. See, there's a little more detailed point of theology that I just love that. To see Jesus touching sick people to heal them. That is awesome.
Yes.
Okay? Yeah, Fred?
Can you imagine being there with Jesus and he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead? He says, oh, I want you to go over there and open that tomb up. Now, I would think there was a little bit of time before someone just jumped up there and grabbed it, and they thought, do I really
want
to do this?
Exactly.
You know,
there would be that hesitation.
More thought to it than just what we read.
Yes, there is. You're absolutely right. Yeah, there would have been some hesitation and questioning and, you know, what's going on here? And actually, in the account of Lazarus, it does say, but he's been dead 4 days. There's going to be an odor. So there was hesitation. There was apprehension. Yeah. All right, continuing on. Verse 4. Those who stood by said, would you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Is that an apology? Sorta. Half an apology? I think it's half an apology, right? Paul's saying, oh, I didn't realize he was the high priest, which Paul wouldn't have known. He's been on the road on missionary journeys. He wouldn't have known. And he's saying, oh, sorry, I didn't know, because God does say, he wants to uphold God's law. God does say, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. You know, we have a couple of presidents recently where half the country hates one president and half the country hates the other president. And yet, my wife reminded me a few times, for my own remembrance, she said, you still have to respect the office of the president, whether it's a president you like or don't like, either the previous one or this one. It seems like everybody in the country hates one and loves the other. Okay? So Paul here is saying, I didn't know. Sorry, I didn't know. So if Paul had known that Ananias was the high priest, Would he still have responded? Now, this is just Pastor Measel speculating. I think Paul would have still have responded, why did you strike me, or what was that for, or tell me the cause of that. But he wouldn't have said this this harsh response. God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. And see, it's got an exclamation point. That's accurate. So I think Paul would have left that out and been a little more respectful in his response had he known it was Ananias was the high priest. That's my speculation about this, okay? It is kind of half an apology from Paul, I think. All right? Okay, moving on. Now, when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, oh, he's clever here. What did Jesus often do when they tried to trick him? He turned it around and placed a question to the accusers that got them all tied up in knots, and they didn't know what to do. There was one time he turns the question around, and they said, well, if we say this, then the crowd will be mad at us. If we say that, then we look like fools. So they said, we don't know, or they answered, yeah, you know, without an answer. So Jesus did this a lot. I think it's very clever. So Paul's being clever here. He perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees. He cried out in the council, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, no angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. So he splits them. He gets them arguing half against the other half. Because he knows exactly the issue. The Sadducees deny the resurrection. The Pharisees recognize the resurrection. Okay? Now, is he telling the truth? Is that why he's on trial? Yes.
Yes.
Because what has he been preaching that's gotten everything all upset? That Jesus rose from the dead. So it is with respect to the hope of eternal life because Jesus rose from the dead. And is Paul telling the truth that he's a Pharisee? No. Yeah, he was a Pharisee. He calls himself a Pharisee of Pharisees. Trained by one of the top teachers of the time, Gamaliel himself. So he's telling the truth here, but he's using the truth to kind of divide the council. Again, I think it's kind of clever. And what do they start doing? They have a dissension between them. They start arguing. The assembly was divided. All right. Okay? Lots of comments? All right. Verse 9. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply. We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? Well, first of all, a spirit or an angel did speak to him. The angel spoke to him. The angel of the Lord. That is one of Jesus' titles. Jesus spoke to Paul, right? He appeared to him on the road to Damascus. So, yes, the Spirit, through Jesus, and the angel of the Lord did speak to him. So that is true. So what are some of the Pharisees saying here? Well, he's one of us, so we find nothing wrong with him. Does humanity even today kind of arrange itself into little cliques? Little groups, and well, he's one of us, so he's okay, even though he may not be. You know, and so we have prejudices, don't we? Towards those who are like ourselves. That's not a good thing. I have, at some place recently, I just had somebody ask me about racism, and I paused them for a minute and I said, well, racism is unbiblical because there's only one race, the human race. So, you know, to have some kind of prejudice or racism against someone else is, yeah, I would say that's biblically wrong because we are all part of the human race. There's only one race. But humanity likes to divide ourselves up into little pods or groups or cliques. And here are the Pharisees too. They're mad at Jesus, at Paul. They're mad at Paul, and yet because he's one of them, oh, we think he's innocent. Well, he is innocent. So that's the correct conclusion, but for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
Right? But you see the drama going on here?
No.
Oh, my goodness. It's like a junior high. They're all arguing and debating about different things. All right. We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? Verse 10. And when the dissension became violent, The tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. Why is it that there's this tendency within humanity that when we have a dispute and we can't settle it with words, we resort to fisticuffs, you know, to violence?
Sin.
Sin, yeah, right. Now, it's not all of us. I think a vast majority of humanity can control its temper and just debate without resorting to violence. But there are some, sadly, that resort to violence. Here, too. Now, the tribune is afraid for Paul, and he knows Paul's a Roman citizen, right?
Yes.
So he's got to protect him. This trial has not concluded. They've gotten nowhere. So he sends the soldiers in, bring out Paul, make sure he's protected. We don't want him. He's a Roman citizen. Maybe the tribune is feeling a little embarrassed that he almost flogged a Roman citizen without a trial, which would be a punishment for the tribune. So he rescues Paul. They keep him overnight. Verse 11, the following night the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. So Jesus appears to him, probably a dream, but it could have been a vision, I don't know, waking vision, something. But, because some of you, is the Lutheran Study Bible got red letters in it for Jesus?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in red, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. It is in
yeah.
red.
Oh, yeah.
It's in red. So, yes, this is Jesus talking, and he says, don't worry, Paul. I'm going to protect you, because not only do I want your testimony here in Jerusalem, which you just did, but I want you to testify or, you know, spread the gospel, preach in Rome as well. Well, that's the heart of the lion's den, isn't it? Paul already doesn't care, does he? He said previously, if you remember, this is a few weeks ago, as he was concluding his third journey and heading towards Jerusalem, he kept getting warnings from people. Don't go to Jerusalem, they're going to arrest you. And Paul said, what do I care? I finished my life, I finished my purpose. If they kill me, so what? I've done what Jesus asked me. So Paul was unconcerned about his own personal safety. Well, this would give him extra peace of mind, I think, to have Jesus appear to you and say, don't worry, this is all going to end up with you in Rome, so you can preach there. And so Paul's like, all right, I already wasn't worried, I didn't care, but yeah, it gives him an extra measure of courage and peace, I think. All right, comments or questions so far? We're about halfway through. All right, a lot of drama going on here. Here's more drama. Verse 12. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul.
Oh, my.
Yeah. That's not all the Jews, but some of the Jews, they so hate Paul at this point. We're going to assassinate him, and you know what? We're going to vow to each other, we're going to fast, until that point where we can get him assassinated. Verse 13, there were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. Now, there's an odd detail. Why? And how do we know it was 40? Well, you're about to find out why we know that number. Verse 14, they went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near. So this is a set of Jews that are not part of the council, but what do they do with members of the council? There's a word for this. Conspiracy. Right? They are conspiring with some members of the council. So here's corruption. They're conspiring with some members of the council. Make up this pretense that you want Paul to come back. We're going to finish the trial. And when he's on the way, we'll assassinate him. And guess what? The council agrees. Oh, that's terrible. This is conspiracy. Are they whitewashed tombs at this point? Yeah. They're looking proper on the outside, but inside they're conspiring and they're corrupt, trying to kill Paul illegally. Okay? All right. Verse 16. Now the son of Paul's sister heard of the ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Now I find this interesting. First place we hear that Paul has family. Right? So, That's okay. So Paul has a sister, and the sister's son, so that would be what to Paul?
Nephew.
A nephew, yes, his nephew. Now, why is the nephew there? Well, somebody last night pointed out, and I think, because I said, how is it that the nephew got the ability to enter the barracks? Well, Paul is a Roman citizen, so he would have had some rights, including, like, visitation. And somebody last night pointed out, I thought this was a good observation, if Paul is half Jewish and half Roman citizen because of his parents, his sister would have been also, which means his nephew would have been also. So Paul's nephew was highly likely, probably was considered a Roman citizen. So when he approaches the barracks and there's soldiers on guard, they either would have recognized him as Paul's nephew or known that he was a Roman citizen. They would have given him the ability, a pass, to come in and talk to Paul. Okay? So interesting. I think that's a correct understanding of this. So, Paul's nephew is on the fringes, and he overhears of this conspiracy, this plot, and he goes into the barracks and tells Paul. Verse 17. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." So, he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, as he has something to say to you. The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, let me scroll down a bit here, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent." That's how we know it was 40. That's how we know the details of their vow, because Paul's nephew had overheard, kind of on the fringes of the group, and he goes and tells Paul. Paul tells him to go tell the tribune, and the tribune listens. Now, Paul's a Roman citizen, so the tribune is obligated to protect Paul until such point as he's found guilty, which he has not yet. Okay? Verse 22. "So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, 'Tell no one that you have informed me of these things.'" So the tribune believes him, and he tells the young man, the nephew, we don't know his name, tells him, "Don't say anything to anyone." Now, why is that? Why does he say, "Don't say anything to anyone"? "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things."
We could develop a plan.
Yes and yes. Two answers, both correct. One is, he himself could be in danger. If the Jews found out that Paul's nephew told the tribune about their plot, they would kill the nephew, right? Secondly, the tribune knows he's got to do something, and he wants to make a plan without interference from the Jews. Yeah, so both reasons, really. Yeah, Fred?
How old do you think this nephew was? It's odd because he said he led him by the hand.
Yeah.
That's an odd statement.
It is an odd statement.
So maybe
a teenager, an adolescent of some sort, perhaps?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I noticed that too. That is an odd statement. He led him by the hand. No, you wouldn't do that, one adult man to another adult man.
No.
Yeah. All right. All right, verse 23. "Then he called two of the centurions and said, 'Get ready 200 soldiers. With 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night.'" Wow. What's the footnote say? Third hour of the night, that's 9 p.m. They generally considered sunset was at 6 o'clock, plus or minus a little bit, depending on the season of the year. So the third hour is 9 o'clock. So, what's the tribune going to do? Verse 24, "Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor." And he wrote a letter to this effect. So first of all, how many soldiers is that? 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. 470, commanded by two centurions. That's more than their normal allotment. Wow! That's a pretty heavy guard.
That is.
Only because there's 40 of rebels that are looking to assassinate Paul? Seems to me like overkill. But I think the Tribune is trying to make extra sure because he knows he almost flogged a Roman citizen and that would cause severe punishment to himself. So he's being extra nice here, I think. So, he's got all of these, and what are they going to do? That very night, 9 o'clock, they're going to leave. They're going to escort Paul out. And where are they taking Paul?
To Felix.
Caesarea to Felix the governor. What do you call this? We have a little phrase for this. I think Teddy Roosevelt had a sign on his desk that, I don't know if it's true or not, but to this same effect. What is this called?
The buck stops here.
Teddy Roosevelt had a sign, the buck stops here. This is passing the buck, right? The Tribune says, I don't know what to do. I'm flabbergasted. I almost flogged this guy who's a Roman citizen. We tried to put him on trial properly. It fell apart into violence. I'm not sure what to do. Now I hear there's a plot to kill him. I'm going to pass the buck up to my boss. I'm going to send him to my boss and say, here you go, you deal with this. I remember before I became a pastor when I was working for Comerica, my boss accused me of doing that a few times. He said, this is your job. Why are you asking me to do this? Well, I'm busy doing this. I just need your help in getting, you know, the clearances for these approvals. I was asking him to get some approvals for the project I was working on. He said, you're trying to pass the buck vertically up to me. And I said, well, yeah, I guess I am. So, yes, he's trying to pass the buck to Felix the governor. So Felix the governor would be the equivalent of Pontius Pilate, okay, at this point. So the Tribune, you know, the military and Roman governments, the military reported to the politicians, kind of like we have in America. So the politicians, the governors would be replaced or moved from time to time, but they have control over the military that reports right to them. Okay? All right, so he's passing the buck, and he writes a letter. What's the letter say? Here we go. Okay, how are we on time? Oh, we're pretty good. Verse 26, Claudius Lysias. So there's the name of the Tribune, and that can be cross-referenced, I think, with Roman history. So, I mean, it's grounded in history. Claudius Lysias, now we find his name. To His Excellency the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. Ooh. Even the Tribune is a little bit political here, isn't
yeah.
he? Because what's the truth? It happened in the opposite way. He didn't. He makes it sound in this letter like, well, I learned he was a Roman citizen, so I went and rescued him from a mob. No, it's actually the opposite way. He arrested him as part of the mob and then learned that he was a Roman citizen. Claudius here, yes, he's covering himself.
Yes.
He's kind of smoothing it over so that he doesn't get in trouble for almost flogging him. Okay? Yeah, so there's a little bit of politics going on right here in this letter. All right, see, drama? Oh, there's drama in this chapter, isn't there? Verse 28, so having learned that he was a Roman citizen, and desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. Yeah, that's true. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there was a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So, did he find nothing that he was being accused of that was deserving of death or imprisonment? That's kind of true. So he's telling the truth there. I think Claudius, the Tribune, he kind of realizes this is a dispute on religious matters between these Jews and one of their own. This doesn't rise to Roman law, and this doesn't rise to the level of an execution. So Claudius is kind of telling the truth here to Felix. And he's right. From a Roman standpoint, they're like, we don't really care, other than we want to keep the peace. That's part of what they valued, remember, Romans? So we don't want this riot going on. It could lead to a rebellion. So that's the bigger issue here. So Claudius is telling the truth to Felix here. And it was disclosed to me there was a plot, so I sent him to you to deal with, you know, passing the buck up to you. All right? Comments or questions? Other thoughts?
Well, just that sounds just like Jesus on trial.
It does, doesn't it? Absolutely. Did Pontius Pilate know that Jesus was innocent? He did.
Sure.
He interrogated him privately. He knew Jesus was innocent. And frankly, it was just a religious matter and he didn't care. And yet he allowed the Jews to continue, the Jewish leaders, to continue to accuse Jesus. And eventually what did Pilate do? He caved in and agreed to have him executed, crucified. Yes, there's a lot of parallels here between this with Paul and what happened to Jesus, right? All right. So the last paragraph here, we'll wrap it up then. Verse 31. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day, they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. Well, that's a little curious. Antipatris is halfway from Jerusalem to Caesarea. So the soldiers go halfway, and then they go back, and the horsemen continue on. Well, that's an odd little detail in my mind. Why are they doing that when it says according to their instructions? So the tribune must have said that.
How far is it?
Oh, what's the distance? Does anybody see anything in your study Bible? What's the distance Jerusalem to Caesarea? I'm thinking like 30 miles total.
30 miles, yeah.
30
so
miles?
Miles on here.
So about 15 miles, about halfway.
They were walking, right?
Yeah.
Soldiers, so
well, and that's, I'm thinking, the tribune is like, I want my soldiers back in my barracks. I don't want to relinquish them for too long. The horsemen, and Paul's on horseback, they can finish the ride on horseback much quicker. So they can go on, and then the horsemen can return to me in another day or two.
You also said that the tribune, if they knew that he knew, would be in danger. So maybe he wanted his soldiers back to protect him.
Well, yeah, he probably wanted his soldiers back to prevent an uprising or to protect himself as well. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So that's kind of interesting little detail that I don't know has any meaning to the greater story. Verse 33. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. Why did he ask that?
Asked about
yeah. You know, it's kind of like any good leader. Is this really my problem? Do I have to deal with this? And he's like, well, if he's from somebody else's province, I'm going to send him over to, you know, the Tetrarch or the other governor or whoever else. I'm going to send him elsewhere. That's what he would do. So he asked what province he's from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, that's the Roman name for the area, he said, okay, I guess I got to deal with this. That's not what he said. He's but close to that. Verse 35, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. So there's going to be some number of days, probably more like weeks, a couple of weeks, because what's going to happen? The Jewish leaders the next day realize that Paul has been taken away during the night. They're going to be upset. Claudius, the tribune, is going to say, yeah, I didn't know what to do. I sent him to the governor over in Caesarea. You can go make your accusations over there. So clearly, Claudius would be passing the buck. So then the Jews would have to formulate their posse, their group, and come up with their accusations and then make a journey over to Caesarea and make their official accusations before Felix, the governor. So it's going to be probably a week or a couple of weeks before anything more takes place. Now, a couple things to observe here that really don't have any meaning for the greater thing here, but it's just some interesting details. Somebody last night said, well, what about their vow to not eat or drink until they kill
yeah.
Paul? Are they going to starve to death?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Right. No doubt they were forced to break their vow and start eating again. Okay? This is kind of funny.
Yeah,
so they make this vow, and now we're going to fast until we kill Paul. And now they can't. So they're going to have to break that vow. The second thing is, where do they keep Paul? Where do they keep him while they're waiting?
Praetorium.
Now let's see. Who in here was on the trip to Israel? Fred was. The Druze were. Anyone else? The trip to Israel. They were on the trip to Greece. But the trip to Israel. Do you remember when we stopped in Caesarea Maritima? Do you remember we saw Herod's Praetorium, the ruins of it?
Yeah.
Where was it?
Up along the seashore.
Yes, right on the seashore. And what was part of it? A big pool. There was a big pool. It was set up a little bit right on the Mediterranean coast. And what was off to the side of the Praetorium? There was the horse track for entertainment. They would have chariot races. Behind them is the city. And you remember, if you're facing the Mediterranean Ocean, and this is Herod's Praetorium, back right over here was the amphitheater. Do you remember that? This is all in Caesarea Maritima. The only reason I bring this up, not only because some of us have been there, but this is a grand palace. Where is Paul being kept?
In a palace.
In a palace! Well, now, you know, they're treating Paul awfully nicely, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
That's pretty cool. I mean, if you got to be under house arrest while you wait for your trial, you might as well be under house arrest in a palace.
Right. Be entertained.
Be well treated, be entertained, have a swimming pool to swim in. Yes, it was quite a good place to be under house arrest. I just find that kind of a little interesting. We got that detail in Herod's Praetorium, and we still have the ruins of Herod's Praetorium today, and it was a grand palace. All right. That brings us to the end of the chapter. We still got 5 minutes, so time for questions or discussion. Any thoughts? Any other observations? Yeah, Joanne.
Well, you know, I noticed throughout here, and this is what you just talked about, the Praetorium, I answered this, that many places it says, take him down to, go get him and bring him down to.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, the city was up on the hill a little bit, and Herod's Praetorium was down from that, but above the water. It was, you know, I think of all these, you know, grand, rich mansions like on the coast of California that are sitting up on the cliff and they're looking out over the ocean. It was like that. So, yes, they're coming down from the city, but it was right on the coastline. Gorgeous view.
It was right on the water.
Yeah, it was.
It was like the water was splashing up against
it. Yep. It was pretty nice. All right.
It seemed like there'd be a good security detail there also.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a good point. I volunteer to be one of the soldiers to guard Paul. I get to stay in the palace and guard Paul in there.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
That would be a good soldier duty. Yes, it would. Yeah. Alec?
Well, I didn't know if we were done yet. I've got a prayer request.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions? Okay. What's your prayer request?
I just got a text telling that he's at Eleanor Hobie at my heart aim and fell and broke her hip.
Oh, no. Oh, is she at the hospital here? I'll have to try and visit her maybe after the surgery. So she's there today right now?
I think, yes.
Yeah, okay.
She fell yesterday.
Okay. Eleanor Hobie. Some of you know her. She's a member here. She's been a shut-in for quite a while. She fell and broke her hip, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Those hips.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's rise and we'll pray. I'll have a prayer for Eleanor and then we'll finish with the Lord's Prayer. Okay? Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for the gift of medicine and the doctors and nurses. We pray that you'd be with Eleanor as she is undergoing surgery even today, right now. Give them all the skill and ability and wisdom to have the surgery go without complication, and give Eleanor patience and peace as she waits for her body to heal. Lay your hand upon her and help her to know that you are with her through all things. Taught by our Lord and trusting in his promises, we are bold to pray,
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses,
as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation,
but deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom, and the power,
and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day. And remember, all